Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. Hello, and thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. Today we have a new story and we have an amazing storyteller. I have the pleasure to welcome you, Carmen, to Urbanistica podcast. Hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm really good. It's a very busy week here in Birmingham, Alabama, United States. It is Magic City Classic Week, which is a full week of events that leads up to an American football game on Saturday, where there will be more than 100,000 people hanging out between two historically black universities, Alabama A&M and Alabama State. So this has been going on for more than 80 years. Nice. It is the largest event of its type in the country. So I'm up early.
What time is it now, by the way?
It's about 8:15 in the morning here.
Okay.
Which I know to a lot of people is not early. That's like, well, that's what time work starts. But for me, it's early.
Yeah. What time do you usually wake up and start then start work?
I'm usually a 9 a.m. starter.
Okay.
So to speak. I'm not a morning person. I am a nocturnal person. I am a night timer. So I'm already working against my nature. But and as the seasons change and it's still dark, you know, when my alarm goes off, I struggle a lot this time of year.
I understand. Same here in Sweden. You wake up, it's dark, and then you go to work, and when you go out and go back home, it's dark, so you don't see a sun.
Right. Yeah, and as a person that adores the sun, it's hard this time of year. I actually just sat in the park. We have a park across from City Hall. Mm. And like I just sat on a bench and just sat in the sun while it was up because I missed the sun already.
So, Carmen, we have listeners from 140 countries, and I'm so happy that you're here and going to inspire us. Give us a short highlight about you, Carmen.
Yeah, well, I am born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, here in the United States. Very historic place in regards to the civil rights movement here in the United States. I've lived other places around the American South, traveled other places. But I developed an interest and a passion for government work while I was in college. I had always intended to be an international businesswoman.
Nice.
When I was in college. So I graduated from the University of Alabama in Huntsville with a degree in foreign language and international trade, with my foreign language being Spanish. And I happened to graduate during the Great Recession. So most people, I went to graduate school because there wasn't work. It was just, I finished in 2006 and we were just going downhill. And I thought, oh, I can go work for the federal government. But I took a local government class. I wandered into one class in graduate school called local government. And I was like, I'd rather do this. So I was bit by the local government bug. and have been active in it ever since in transportation planning and policy, community economic development, business development for ethnic minorities and gender minorities, placemaking, affordable housing, the whole gamut, that works to make the government work for more people.
Mm. But why this field attracted you so much and you became so passionate about it, like this profession?
I think it's foundational to people's well-being. I think that there are a lot of people working on a lot of things. To me, that seems more upstream or more downstream, rather.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, we need to fix this or we want to work on this. And I'm like, well, if people don't have anywhere to live, you know, like that is a fundamental, foundational part of people's well-being. Like, you know, you working on your, you know, whatever it is, further down the stream, you know, while it may make you feel good, it's not going to be as effective because we don't have enough people going into the funnel upstream.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it is. It's like these are, you know, people having places to live that are safe and affordable and having access to quality education. And having transportation to get that education and try those jobs or have support to be entrepreneurs. These are just like, to me, the foundational building blocks of civilization. Mm. So I'd rather work there. So the work that other people are doing downstream, like there are more people who can benefit because they have the building blocks they need.
Yeah. Are you enjoying what you work with now?
Yes. Yeah. I really enjoy my job. I am currently chief of staff to a city councilwoman, Carol Clark, here in Birmingham, Alabama. We represent, she represents, I work for her, District 8 in Birmingham, which is, you know, very dense. It's not a lot compared to other districts. It's not as large because it does have some densely populated neighborhoods, but it is also home to 3 sports venues. Including the oldest baseball field in the United States. So it's really this dynamic and diverse. Yeah, we have a college, a football stadium, another sports facility, commercial space, but also really dense neighborhoods. Yeah. Some of them having great architectural significance, which I know you have architecture fans on here. We have some great architecture here in Birmingham as well. And so, you know, it's been a great exercise in getting to know people, different kinds of people at different stages of life. We do have a lot of people who are older, but our older residents are much more active. Like I remember as a young person thinking of an old person and thinking, oh, they're old, they can't move, they don't do, but these older people now are much more active, much more proactive. They're interested in their neighborhoods. Mm. So we get to work with them on projects, placemaking projects in their neighborhoods. Mm. And they want vibrant neighborhoods that, you know, that match the vitality that they have as individuals. So it's fun to work with them.
Yeah. Tell me like about a project that you worked on.
So one of the things that we do consistently is that once a week we meet at the Starbucks in our district and we walk a mile and a half with our residents. Like I said, mostly older. And so it's a great way to exercise with them on a weekly basis to get like just, you know, get the body moving. But it's also a great way to talk with them and understand more about how they're feeling, what they're seeing in the neighborhoods. Mm. Obviously, staff, you know, we can't be everywhere all the time. So this is a great opportunity to just converse with them and get an understanding of what's happening and all of that. We're also using some funds from the American Rescue Plan Act to do some greening in our neighborhoods. We're transforming a space on one of the main roads that's experiencing a lot of erosion. I believe that like the retaining wall has broken. and we want to use funds to make it a more passive green space where people can kind of walk through and experience some cooling, just like this really calming place. But just to provide a neighborhood amenity that's native planted, smartly landscaped, so it's not another maintenance headache, but an opportunity for people in the immediate area to experience like some green space and just to have another place to relax. We're planting trees in our parks to provide shade so that when kids go out and play, they're not just in the scorching sun all the time, or parents and guardians have somewhere to sit under a tree while they're watching kids play. And we're also working on a more robust project in one of our neighborhoods of creating this gateway that is this, you know, more hardscaped public space that is being co-designed with neighborhood residents and some of the school children. So it's a lot going on, but it's good stuff.
It's good stuff, of course. But tell me about the process. Like, when you listen from people in the community, let's say they have feedback to do this or develop this and so, or to fix this. How is the process from the time you hear, you take this data until you fix the problem or create the new thing or develop a new place?
Yeah, so the way our local government functions, we have a strong mayor system. So the mayor actually administrates the government. So depending on what the issue is, our office may not have any jurisdiction over executing the project. So we act more in an advocacy capacity or we're the reminder button. You know, we're like, hey, guys. We need this project. Hey, guys, we just heard from the residents. They're still having issue with this. So that happens. But then there are some things that can fall within our purview. And if we have the funding and if it makes sense, you know, we will take care of in our office. But those things tend to be more programmatic. Mm-hmm. Anything infrastructure related or that, you know, calls for the removal of dirt. I like to say anything that's going to move the earth. has to be handled by the administration. But, you know, we fund projects or programs rather at our local library to make sure that our seniors have social activities. We have a really robust computer literacy program for our seniors. So a lot of the things that we do out of our office are more programmatic than it is like actual physical projects because of the way our government is bifurcated.
And when you work a lot with people in the same area, you start to, like, how to say, build a community and relationships. So you have like a network of people now in the community?
Yes. I mean, and you get to know them, you get to know their families. What goes on, you know, they're checking on you, you're checking on them. you know, if I don't see somebody that if we have a few walks and one of my regulars is not there, you know, we're going to call and make sure they're okay. And we do encourage that kind of neighborly activity. You know, if you haven't seen a neighbor, you know, check on them, particularly, you know, as we hit into winter with flu season and COVID on the rise for us and things like that. We are encouraging, you know, these social connections and social cohesion to just keep up with people. To make sure people are doing okay. But yeah, it's been a great exercise in just intergenerational communication and dialogue. You know, when we're walking, it's usually like you're out there walking with two or at least three different generations of people and experiences. And, you know, we're all, you know, just talking and figuring things out together. So that's cool.
Where is the line or the boundary between Carmen working in the city council and Carmen, like, let's say, just the citizen, the neighbor? Is it like there is a line between these two or no? You're the same. I'm talking like more relationship wise with the community.
Oh, yeah. You know, I so that my council representative is not the counselor I work for. And I actually realized, like, I probably should ask my actual representative for more things, but I don't. It's like, we were up there and I'm like, okay, if I need something, I could just, figure it out myself. But I do want to, as I settle, I do want to distinguish more between my employee self and my actual neighborhood self, and what I'm like with my neighbors, what kind of events I'm hosting at my home, and things like that. That is a very good question. I don't think I've ever thought about like how I distinguish because you just kind of roll with it. I mean, I guess at some point, if I will return to just being a resident, but I don't know. That is, I'm going to have to think about that some more.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners working with the community engagement processes and so on, including me as well. So, let's say, what are the three key elements that create a strong relationship between us working, let's say, with placemaking or development? And then a neighborhood or a community, what should we like really think about and keep in mind?
One is honesty, integrity. I know that's two words, but they go together, honesty and integrity, particularly in populations that don't have a historically good relationship with the government. Okay. I think we take for granted that people love the government or they trust the government implicitly or they've always had this positive relationship, and that's not true. Depending on the people, the population, and the history of the place, you have to show up, honestly and with integrity and understanding. This is probably all three now. Understanding how this population of people perceive the organization that you represent.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's going to dictate whether, first of all, whether or not they believe anything that you say. And two, how or if they participate. So I think that's one thing. Secondly, I think there is the listening part and suspending a bit of your expertise. So, I talk about this often. We go and we get our fancy degrees and we go around the world studying things and we have all this knowledge information and rightfully so, we want to share it with people. It's like, well, you should do this and you should do that. But I think there's a humility that we should also couple with our expertise so that residents are the ones who are driving these decisions. Now, I will say, I don't let people drive us off of a cliff. I will step in from time to time, like, hey, we need to move this in a different direction. You know, I will employ, but I will give them a reason and back it up with expertise as to why we don't, like what the potential outcomes would be if we go this direction. So we want to try something else.
Yeah.
But, I'm thinking, using your expertise more as guardrails. There's this balance of letting or having residents design, co-design their community and using to their benefit the expertise and knowledge that we've gathered.
Yeah.
And so you have to strike that balance. And it's not always easy because there are many times I am like bursting on the inside and I'm like, no, no more parking. this is what they want, but this is also, a lot of people have a very singular experience of cities and because they haven't studied and haven't been around. And so there's like always this dance of, okay, how do I introduce different topics or different ideas without being dismissive of the things that they want or making people feel like they're less intelligent or, or that their ideas are not good or worthy. So that's like the second part. It's like striking that balance of expertise and humility so you need to manage that relationship. And lastly, I think fun, enjoyment, the passion, because I think people respond well to me because I'm passionate about this. I'm really into it. They know that they know me as a person. They know I wouldn't, the kind of person that I am, I would not do something that's harmful. I think that when people see that you have this infectious passion for a particular subject, you know, they're more willing to listen to you and they enjoy working with you because it's a peaceful process. It's a joyful process. It's an exciting process. And, you know, it doesn't get lost in all the other things. Because sometimes that happens, you know, we have projects that go on, things that pop up. And being able to make sure that this train stays on the tracks and it actually goes and the project actually gets done, you know, is another real skill. So I think, just, you know, honesty, integrity, humility with your expertise and being passion forward to really bring people along this emotional journey of create co-creation is what I say.
Yeah. Very, very good, elements that we can work on. But sometimes, you know, Carmen, like we don't have enough time to build a strong relationship with the community. Like, let's say we are there for very few hours and then we leave and go back to the office and work on the project. So many of us try to maximize the output in these 2 hours or 4 hours, you know. At the same time, sometimes we feel that the community are not really giving everything they have. They have more, but it's because we are very new in the relationship, so they don't give everything. So how can we think there to maximize the output at the same time, make them feel good and, you know?
Yeah, I think, well, when I'm in those situations, I tell people up front, I'm like, hey, listen, so we only have 5 hours.
So being super honest, yeah.
We only have 3, like this is what we have. And, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to, you know, extract information in this amount of time and this amount of people. Like I put everybody on task. This is what we have. Yeah. And bring them into the process. So it's a co-facilitation. But I also think like some research prior, like researching communities, you know, understanding if possible, like what are their informal networks? What are their cultural customs? Yeah. How is information passed? You know, is this a highly literate internet community that where they're all online, or is this more of an informal, because some of our neighborhoods are this way, like we can tell one person in the neighborhood and that one person has like some sort of informal calling tree and they can disseminate information. So I think there's some research beforehand and just getting as much as you can of understanding about how this community operates and how they've been historically treated or what they've been interested in before. And then showing up and saying, hey, we have a very limited time, but it doesn't mean that we don't get a quality project or a quality product. And just, you know, and bringing that challenge to them to say, hey, you know, I know you may not know me and I'm a new face, but this is our job. This is our task. And this is the decisions that we're making here are multi-generational decisions. And so you have the honor and the responsibility to be here to co-create and create this for people you don't even know, for people who are yet born. And so, like, how can we do this responsibly? I put it back on them. I'm like, you know, this is your community.
It's true. I play the same card as well. Like, I tell them, we have, let's say, 2 hours, and this is the project. We cannot change it now. We have this opportunity, we have these cards, so we have to play the best game of what we have in our hands. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's a bit like difficult because they don't feel really comfortable in sharing everything and feel that it's like very quick. 2 hours is not enough, or 4 hours is not enough, and so on. Sometimes I love also to ask you, sometimes they are angry because of like how they were treated from the council or the city during the past years. But we are the face of the city, so every anger, all the anger coming on us.
Yeah, I think in those situations, I like to do a lemon squeeze. That's what I call it. And just let you get it out. Like everybody gets to write down something, you know, unless it's like we're talking about a large issue that needs to be facilitated by somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, write it down. Write down your grievances and post them over here. Because we can't get to what we need to do if it's blocked by this particular negative energy.
Yeah.
And what I say is that we're just putting it in the parking lot, so to speak. We're not dismissing it. We're not saying we're not going to turn it in. We're not saying we're going to do anything other than just sit it right here so we can get to the task at hand.
Yeah.
Now, if we go ahead and get to work, we can have time in the end to come back to these things. And, you know, obviously we can still pass them on to whomever they need to go to at the government or the organization. But I think, you know, acknowledging that people do have feelings about things and giving them an opportunity to express it and visualize it, like it exists, it is real, affirmed, it is there, but we need to park it right there for right now, just for these 2 hours or however long we're together so we can get to what we're doing and then go back and address it or however you need to pass it on to whomever.
Did it happen a lot of times to you, or maybe if there was like one time they were really, really angry?
Yeah, I mean, we've had some meetings that kind of get hijacked a bit on a singular topic that, you know, and we try to bring it back. But yes, I have been both successful and unsuccessful in managing the quote unquote lemon squeeze of the process. Because I think also one of the issues is that, you know, when we're out in the field, this is how they interact with the government. Like they're not in City Hall, or they may not understand the structure or whom they need to be speaking with about a certain issue. So as soon as they see me or they see you or someone else, they're like, hey, you. It's like, whoa, I don't know how to do that, or I don't know how to, you know, it's like. But it doesn't matter because you represent
the city,
the organization.
Yeah.
So yes, I've been in meetings where I've wanted to. We were talking about sustainability measures to, you know, obviously lower costs and beautify neighborhoods. Understanding, you know, our stormwater system is it's old. You know, infrastructure all over the world is older. And, you know, I'm trying to talk about like green initiatives and like people just want to like, they're like, no, but like, what about the parks? Like, cause it was some trees that fell in the park. And I'm like, what? No, we're talking about, something, you know, like, no, I'm talking to you about, you know, how we're going to manage stormwater. Like, don't put your leaves in the giant bag, your leaves, you know? And it's like, no, they want to talk about parks. And so sometimes it goes well and, you know, we're able to manage conversations, and sometimes the emotions are so big that we can't, like depending on what it is and how recently it happened, you're not actually able to park it. You kind of have to take it.
Yeah, exactly. You need just to let them, talk and give this energy that they have, because as you mentioned, we are like the face of the city, or like ambassadors from the city. And I don't blame the community, because sometimes they don't see anybody from the city. Like, it's very hard to reach out, you know,
other than the people who pick up the garbage. I mean, you think about it, those are the most visible like public works, the most visible of the city employees. Like, you see those people at least once a week. They come pick up your garbage. They're out cutting grass. They're doing something. Then secondary will be police and fire, but everybody else is at City Hall.
Exactly. Here in Sweden, some cities, it's impossible to get in touch with a person who's responsible, or you need to talk. Mm-hmm. It's usually, okay, leave your feedback on email or email us and we will send it further. And because of this big organizational structures, it's a kind of, there is a big gap between the people and people working in the city. And that's why when people, let's say, meet us, they be like, okay, this is my only chance to say what I have. And happen a lot of times to me, like they talk about something else than the topic of what I want or my project, and in the end, like, I just listen and say, okay, I will note this down, and I send, give it to the responsible person, and they will reply you. But it's so sad to see that people who are working in the city, of course not all of the cities, not all we are commenting this group only, people working in the city who has the mission to make people's life better and better quality. At the same time, they are not even close to them. They're not even visible.
Yeah, it is. Part of it's like the nature of the job, right? So like if you're the person who examines all the building plans, then no, you don't really get to leave because you're there looking to make sure that all the buildings are being built correctly. Yeah. So some of like the nature of some of the jobs just doesn't allow.
That's true.
In the normal course of doing the job to be out. But I do think that like people should almost be kind of mandated like a few hours every month. You got to get out, like everybody, even the receptionists, like who are answering the phones or making the appointments, that you kind of got to get out and see people and meet people. Just to kind of see what's going on, just to kind of get an understanding and try to touch people and see what's going on. Because I think great ideas and solutions can come from anybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're not, you know, putting our best foot forward, essentially locking folks up in City Hall or the courthouse, because anybody could get up and go somewhere and see something and have a brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, yeah, by the nature of some jobs, you're kind of stuck there, but you do need to work on, you know, just at even once a quarter, once a month, getting folks out to just see.
Yeah, exactly. Like just to get in touch with what you work for, you know, like the you're doing all this for people.
Right.
So just get in touch with them, see how they experience what you create, and hear and listen from them. Not only like sitting behind the screens and reading papers and so on. Like, just go once in a month, in a week. Just go out and see how is life being outdoor.
I think that's a great idea. If you are one of the receptionists who set up a meeting between, you know, someone in the community and someone inside, and then like there's this project that now exists because of that, you should go see the project. You should go see what you have participated in. You know, the building inspector, I mean, the plans person needs to actually go see the physical building that they were, you know, monitoring on paper. Because I think that also just keeps you grounded and interested in your job. I think, you know, you can get very, you know, rhythmic and robotic in what you're doing. It becomes very rote. And, you know, getting out and seeing the actual thing that you participated in, I think really does help ground you and reinvigorate your passion for what it is that you're doing.
Yeah. It's also good for the body when you move, you know, good for the health.
Yeah.
We talk a bit about like creating equal opportunities for people in a city. When we say equal opportunities, what do we mean by this?
Yeah, so Like I said, you know, historically in the United States, marginalized populations, indigenous people, black people, our neighbors from the South, from, you know, Central and South America, you know, it's been a very difficult and different experience. And I remember, you know, I remember being in high school when 9/11 happened, and I went to high school with folks, kids who were from Lebanon, whose families are from Lebanon, families from India, and other parts of the world, and like their experience and how we, you know, really had a really shameful experience in the aftermath of that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think for me, like when I'm working in government and I'm thinking about things, I am thinking about these basic building blocks, like equal access to clean, safe, affordable housing, you know, access to a quality education and quality extracurricular activities, like whether it's sports, whether it's extra academic assistance. I think about how I was, you know, fortunate enough to get to do other things like Girls Inc. and then go down to Auburn University and like go to their architecture school. I had no intention of being an architect, but it was an experience that like as a child, I got to go to a college campus and I got to know that college existed. Because as crazy as that sounds, like there are, you know, people who grow up who don't have a concept of like, oh, there's of what college is. And so I think about all these different interventions that were public. I mean, Girls Inc. is a nonprofit that receives public funding, you know, having access to libraries where I could go pick up books, or like my local library, the Titusville Library, is the first place I saw a globe. And I could spin the globe and just look at different countries and read or attempt to read different words and just have an awareness of like, oh, the United States is just this little part of like this big old thing, which usually is the reverse here in the United States. We think, you know, in the United States, we think the United States is this big old thing, and it's not. But being able to build that awareness at a younger age to know like, oh, there are other languages, other cultures, and just having the ability for my mind to expand is for me what I think about. I think about these foundational building blocks, food, shelter, water, education, and having the opportunity to expand your mind. I truly think that, you know, if you can, you know, if you can think a little bit outside of yourself, and you take a step in a direction, that all of your resources will meet you. So, you know, there'll be people there to be like, yes, I can write a letter for you. Sure, I can introduce you to someone, or sure, I don't mind donating to help you go on a trip. Like those things exist, but we have to create the physical and social infrastructure for people to be able to meet that opportunity. And so that's the way I look at it. I'm like, when I was in graduate school, we were introduced to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German philosopher, who had this general idea that the role of government is to use our common resources to support the basic human needs of people so that they are in a place to hear God's word. Right, so that they are in a place to actually work towards their divine purpose. But if someone is hungry, they can't hear God. If you're, you know, if you need shelter, if you're experiencing other kinds of distress, you're always in survival mode. So you can't think about why am I here and what talents and skills are already in me that I can actually contribute to society. And so I kind of see it that way too. It's like, if, you know, in order like we need to set people up to be in a space where they can actually pursue the things that they are put here to pursue. And so that's the way I view equal opportunity, is making sure that we're not squandering those resources and we're putting our best foot forward as much as we can to create a society where people can pursue.
To create this, of course, everyone has a part of responsibility. But who is the main responsible for creating equal opportunities?
Well, I mean, obviously the government. I mean, historically here in the United States, it has been the government that has acted in a discriminatory manner. It has been the federal government, our federal government. I mean, still acts in a way that is discriminatory. Our state governments, our local governments, you know, whether it be through redlining, racist covenants, you know, where we deploy resources. My city has almost 120 parks, anywhere between like 115, 120 parks. And not because like we just really love green space, which we do, but because of segregation, we had to have like twice as many. Because one was for whites only, one was for not white people, mostly black people. But we also know that there are more people in the world, but in the United States, the concept of race is very binary. And because of that, so part of that legacy of discrimination is an abundance of infrastructure that we no longer really need, and we definitely cannot financially support. So it is the responsibility of those who work in the government, who manage the government apparatus, to act in a repairing of what was done as much as we possibly can, and to manage the repercussions of those discriminatory acts. So, you know, the housing crisis that we're experiencing in the United States is directly related to, you know, discriminatory practices in housing and where houses were built and the quality of those houses, and the ability for people to get financing to, you know, go into a home. Birmingham has a lot of great housing stock. And I, you know, I don't say this because I want everybody to come to Birmingham and buy, and buy up all our houses. But it is quite affordable. And we do, like, because Birmingham is a blue collar town, right? So we were a steel industry town. We were called the Pittsburgh of the South. My father was a former union steel worker. So I'm like, I know people are like, oh, you're one of those leftist babies. I'm like, yeah, my dad was in the union. But because of that, we have very skilled craftsmen. So we're talking about wonderful brick homes, wonderful architecture, but a lot of them sit empty because people can't access the financing to acquire and renovate a home. It's easier to get financing for more people in a new subdivision after we've like cleared a forest to like throw up all these houses. That's easier to finance than the homes that already exist that just need a little love.
Yeah.
So like things like that, you know, working with these industries like banking and finance, like insurance industries, you know, Black communities being either uninsured or very underinsured. So you think about when people were experiencing violence. So when you would have your home bombed, right, during the civil rights movement, you did not get an insurance settlement to rebuild your house. That did not happen. You know, the community had to come together, or you had to, you know, literally do it yourself with your hands. Or, you know, that was this in, you know, community mechanism that helps people rebuild their houses.
Yeah.
And, you know, and how they built, like the reason that we have a neighborhood called Dynamite Hill, nicknamed Dynamite Hill for that reason, because it was bombed so frequently. But none of those families received insurance payouts. You know, there was no restitution or recompense to set those families back up financially after having their homes destroyed. So there's a lot of gaps that haven't been filled because of the way the government approached things back then. But we're working now. I think that, you know, to give some credit to the Biden administration, not to, you know, toot America's horn here, but they have been very forward and honest about the discrimination that the government has inflicted and putting together programs and opportunities to combat some of it. I don't think there are many things that cannot be reversed. There are things that, some things that can't even be repaired. So that's hard.
Yeah.
That there's just some things we can't fix.
No.
And we're just figuring out how to go forward and, you know, bring people along as best we can. But I felt like I kind of rambled on the answer. So I don't know if it makes
Because this is what we are exploring now. It's like more urbanism through the lens of being Black and an American in the US. And it's a lot of things that we don't really experience or know, that now, like you're telling me, that the number of parks, for instance, this is a crazy thing, no? And what are like the things that makes you, you see the city failed. Let's say maybe not now, maybe in the past, talking more about the Black American community.
Yeah. Whew. Simple things like one-way streets, you know, like where, you know, where one-way streets go, where I, the city that I work for, Birmingham, is, you know, has applied for a grant to actually reverse that, to make, because we had one-way streets going through our historic Black business district. And it's like, well, the shop owners are not going to get any traffic if we have like four lanes going one direction. People are literally speeding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that doesn't help the commercial viability. But so that's the thing. So we can reverse. Yes, we can change the direction of the street.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we can't make up for decades of, you know, non-viability. You know, like the money that you could have made had this not been the case. So that's one of those things. It's like, yeah, we can stop it now, but it doesn't really allow us to fully repair the harm. You know, we're, you know, having conversations about parks and finding a way to assess, you know, which of these parks is the most necessary, which of these parks actually works towards park equity. So I think people think just that because parks exist in vast number, that there's park equity, and that's not necessarily true, because all of the parks are not created equal. They're not the same size. They don't have the same amenities. And so, you know, assessing that and understanding the demographics, you know, how far, not just, you know, how far is a walk to the park, what is the quality of that walk to the park? And, you know, working on that so then we can concentrate resources better to give a better, you know, recreation experience, in hopes that, you know, does increase literacy, improve social cohesion, you know, improve health outcomes, because we have more people coming to a park that they like. It's like, oh, this park is really nice because now it has something that I actually want. And, you know, now we have sports teams, or like, you know, people are doing aerobics and things of that nature. You know, so it's this balancing of being proactive and trying to undo and redo, but So understanding, and not just understanding it, but there's an emotional component of realizing that you cannot fix some things. No. That there are just some things that are broken, or that it's going to take generations to really see the full impact of decisions. Mm-hmm. And that can be very difficult because, like, you want to see it now. Like, if you know, you want to see
exactly
things alleviated immediately, but it's just not possible. Mm-hmm. So it is definitely a balancing act of doing the things that you can do and like the grace around like understanding that there are just things like, you know, we can't really reverse or definitely not, you know, affect deeply immediately.
Exactly. Like we can't see the changes now at the moment. It's like it's going to take years, hopefully not so many, until we see something of what we are changing now. Mm-hmm. And I understand it's very hard that when you want to change something because you had enough of what you see, but at the same time it takes time, especially when it comes to, you know, like cities and this systematic and structural things. Mm-hmm. It's like long time. And it's very annoying.
Yeah. It is very annoying. I mean, the interstate system, the Biden administration does have a program called Reconnecting Communities where they're wanting to, you know, do away with like interstates that, which apparently is like a worldwide thing. I thought it was just an American thing.
Okay.
From the United States. I don't mean to say American to exclude Canadians and Central and South Americans, but I thought it was only a thing from the United States where, you know, interstates would go up in Latino neighborhoods, Black neighborhoods, and essentially like destroy communities. Like it would separate, you put this physical barrier, and similarly with train tracks. When I was in Nairobi earlier this year, I literally saw the same thing. There was like, on this side of the interstate are informal settlements. On this side of the interstate is a neighborhood. Mm. And it's like, you know, this concept of, you know, using infrastructure to divide people or deeming land less valuable solely because of the people who inhabit it. And saying, oh, we can just drive this through your neighborhood. And while I think it is great that we want to address it, I'm like, well, it's already done. It's been up for 50, 60 years.
Right.
Like, I don't know that we can, every case is different, but I'm like, is this something that can be repaired? Mm. And is it as simple as the physical barrier? And I don't think so. There's a psychological barrier that now exists that we have to address. And it's time consuming. And, you know, even though, you know, you and I, we're practitioners, you know, much like your listeners, a lot of the people we deal with are elected. And so there's always this political reality of timing, right? So you can seem effective as an elected person. Mm. And so there's this, there can be, you know, this clash of ideals where we're like, this is what this takes. Mm. And they're like, I only have 4 years.
Exactly.
And you're like, well, and so now you're trying to stick something in a four-year pocket that should take 20 years.
Yeah. And also like, sometimes, how to say, it's a lot of architecture and city planning washing, I call it, that just removing the highway might solve the segregation, or like doing this might, like, physical, removing this physical barrier will solve the segregation. I think it needs a lot of other work as well, not only, like, it's not enough to do this with only like removing a highway or building like a walking path between two communities. We need like really much more.
Mm-hmm. There's much more. There's a social.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about talking to people who were displaced from their homes so that the interstate could be built. And you talk to them and they're like, yes, my childhood, where I grew up, like where I was destroyed. That is not necessarily repairable. I cannot recreate that. And, you know, I don't know what is sufficient to cover that, you know, because there's, I mean, because more than likely, if you were even compensated at all, because again, these were mostly minority communities. If you were even compensated at all, you weren't compensated fairly. And so then like, there's like this setback in your family where you had a home, you were stable, everything was fine. And then now you don't. And now you got to go find a new home and you may not be financially able to do that. And then so like, there's this ripple effect in your family that's gone on for multiple generations. Like, you know, we can't necessarily fix like the wealth or stability that your family would have earned had that not happened. I can't, I don't have a calculator to be like, you know, to calculate that up and say, well, here's what, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's, you know, a lot of the work is social. It is, you know, psychological, you know, and just, you know, helping people work through that trauma and, you know, and how they see us and how they see government, how they see these entities, their desire to work with or not. You know, it's based on those experiences. It's like, you know, do they even believe? I mean, people who go and they say, I don't want this. I don't want this in my neighborhood. I don't want this in my neighborhood. And it still shows up in their neighborhood. And then, like, you're like, well, we don't have good community engagement. They don't want to come talk to us. I'm like, well, they told you they didn't want. They didn't want something, and you did it anyway. And I, like, so what do you think?
Exactly.
Like, how do you think this is supposed to work? You know, they're just supposed to keep showing up, and, you know, when they don't feel heard or listened to, like, that just, that's not how that works. So it's a lot of work.
Exactly. And a lot of work, and not only physical, but also social, economical, and so on. And what I know about you is that you're not only working in the council, but you're also running elevators.
Yes.
And I love to hear more about this. Like, what was the background that you started elevators?
Okay, so elevators is named after my favorite Outkast song, the rap duo from Atlanta. Their song Elevators. And it's really about uplift, like community uplift, which is a theme that we've already kind of discussed, where I'm just really interested in helping people kind of meet those ground level needs so that then they can just like flourish and go on, like, you know, go on up from there. And so what, you know, elevators at the moment, like right now, we're community engagement. So one is, you know, my principles is I don't want engagement to be extractive, which it can and has traditionally been, whether it's from research institutions, banking institutions, you know, brands or whatever. You know, you show up in a community, you get all this information. You know, you either use it to write grants and you never come back to the community. So you're like, you're essentially profiting off of you know, this interaction, but like the community gets nothing from it, you know, other than maybe like a t-shirt, some water bottles, but there's not a meaningful, there's not a meaningful exchange. And so my company Elevators, what we do is that we create these meaningful, mutually beneficial exchanges between communities and companies and organizations. And so I tell my pitch to companies and different organizations that community engagement is a business intelligence tool. That it's not just, you know, you're coming out here, you know, doing your service hours, but you know, if you actually talk to these people and get to know them, you may learn something that would be beneficial to how you run your business or what products you want to push out or even what you advocate for. You know, in your, you know, in your non, in your foundation arm. But you'll never know that if you continue to just show up and pass out water bottles. And I say this as a person who has a cabinet full of water bottles. and so that's what we do. We create, whether it's traditional meetings, conferences, like we've done pop-ups, you know, very creative things. We also work with local creative economies. So any activity that we are paid to do, anything I need to outsource, whether it's a DJ, a caterer, a photographer, they're coming from that community. So I'm hiring from in the community, local creatives. So like, so spending money with our firm actually is more circular. It doesn't just, you know, hang out with me and my friends. It actually goes deeper in your community. And it allows people to try out entrepreneurship. So I like to work with creatives or people who are just starting out or folks who aren't sure, like, well, I don't know if I want to do this. Well, come take pictures for me and see, you know, is this something that you want to do?
Okay.
And then if you like it, then we can talk further about what kind of resources are available in your community and where you can go take your next steps to more fully pursue entrepreneurship at whatever level you want. So it's this twofold thing where I'm working with, you know, these companies to have them have better interactions, but also help, you know, giving a lot of entrepreneurs their first opportunity to try their hand at entrepreneurship in these creative industries.
Yeah. Do companies understand the value of like including and integrating community in their like business model or process and so on? Or it's like still it's difficult to convince them?
I wanted to say, I thought we were seeing some changes in 2020 after the murder of George Floyd. I thought we were having more candid conversations and things of that nature. We've regressed since then, in my opinion. You know, we didn't go as deep as we should have in exploring how companies really interact as a part of community.
Yeah.
Not separate, not like you have government, community, business, but like, no, we're all in the same, we're all here together. I think, you know, there, you know, a lot of funding went out, but not a lot of connections, you know, not a lot of experience, not a lot of people, you know, on the ground, seeing things, making different social connections across different demographics, or even really changing the engagement model. It was just like, oh, we're going to give more funding. But it's like the apparatus itself didn't change.
Exactly.
So I'm like, so the outcomes aren't going to necessarily change either.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, for some companies, depending on how they're run, like we have some companies here locally that are still family owned, family run. They're like, you know, they're not necessarily focused on shareholder profits. Those are the companies. I mean, all companies are run by people, but I'm like, these are people run companies. Like, these are the companies that are, you know, we get better interaction with those companies because they're run by people who grew up here, who have a significant tie to the place. I remember I spent a couple days in the city of Chattanooga hanging out with them when Andy Burke was mayor. And one of his cabinet members was talking to me about Chattanooga and their pollution problem they had because of steel industry or whatever the industry was up there.
Yeah.
And they were saying, well, the reason that it got cleaned up was because the family that owned the mill was from Chattanooga. And they were breathing the bad air too. So they were invested in the community because they were from the community. And oftentimes when you have companies that transplant into your community or they've gotten so big, even if they started off as a local company, they've gotten so big that they're so far removed from those very common interactions. You know, like bumping into somebody at the grocery store, or like you're going out to eat and there's like the person who runs such and such company. Like, you know, but when you're so kind of, you're so far removed from that, you can seem less concerned with what the everyday person is experiencing. And if you're not deliberate about experiencing wherever you are on the ground, then you will continue to miss the mark and continue to invest in a system and an apparatus that does not work.
Yeah. So what you see and observe is like, okay, a lot of fundings within this, but like not really so much of building connection.
Right. And also, I think there's a lot of misalignment. So you have resources going to people who may be well-intentioned, but they're not as talented as someone else. But this person over here who is really good at what they do doesn't have the social capital to be in connection, you know, with the funder.
Yeah.
And so you have a grave misalignment of resources and talent. Mm-hmm. And so you don't see the effectiveness of what you're looking for either, which could then also cause you to not want to do as much, as opposed to really investigating, well, why isn't this working?
But is Elevators a nonprofit organization or like a company?
It's a company. We are a for-profit.
And so you have two jobs, right? One in the council and one.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's both of those things. It's, you know, of course, other placemaking duties. I'll be in Mexico City next week.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's all of those things. It's even, you know, talking to, you know, newcomers to the profession, new planners, new MPAs, new architects who are, you know, trying to figure out how they do their career and make a difference.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, you know, people, when you have an opportunity to grow up somewhere and I tell people, I was like, I learned how to love because I grew up in a community that loved me, you know, like that poured into me, that made sure that we had access to things so that I could go off and learn things. And I think now it is like making space for people, for young people who have gone off to college or gone to do these things, who want to come back and work in their neighborhoods, making space for these people to actually return the gifts that were given to them by their community, and allowing them to work in space and in place and to implement all the things that they have learned and experienced, not as, you know, as a gift, as a gift for what they have been given, and not like seen as this like overbearing, oh, I'm just, I know it all kind of thing. And it's like, no, this is, I'm returning the gift that was given to me by this community. So that is, you know, an encapsulation of how I see my work, not only at the council, but also with Elevators. Yeah. I am working to return this gift that I was given by my community.
That's beautiful. And what challenges you face, like, as a Carmen doing this?
You know, I have, I would say, like, going to Kenya was, like, life-changing. For me, it was my first time in Africa.
Okay.
And I remember having a conversation with some young women there who are in similar profession.
Yeah.
And one young lady, she says, "You're so lucky that you get to be from the United States." And I was am I? Because I had never thought about it that way. I have never thought, oh, I'm so lucky. I have never thought ever. And and not in a sense of, because I know people will hear this and think, oh, you know, you're just so ungrateful because you could be, but that's not that's not what I mean. I, you know, as a person who understands the history of Black people in this country and what we continue to experience, I'm like, yeah. it don't feel like look.
That's true.
So, but from her experience growing up in Kenya and looking across the pond and saying, oh, Black people in America get to do X, Y, and Z. And my response to her, I said, well, it costs a lot. You know, I was like, you know, if you look at the arc of history of Black people in the United States, I mean, it's cost us and continues to cost us a lot. And I don't and I don't think it's ungrateful or weird to want to go to the grocery store and not get shot. You know, like that is not, you know, so I think that, you know, part of the difficulty, not difficulty, but it's just as, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois calls it, double consciousness. It's like I realize what it means to be from the United States. But I only realize that when I'm not in the United States.
Exactly. That's why it's important to travel so you can see that perspective. Like,
yeah, because in the United States, I'm Black. I'm a Black woman, which is a specific thing and a specific experience, which is not the same as people who are opposite of me. But when I'm abroad, to be quote unquote treated like an American, it's something I notice. That's how I know it's different. Like, I'm like, oh, this is, you know, this is different. This is not, and to experience it and try to process it. It's difficult because I remember being in Amsterdam and I met this Ghanaian fellow and I was like, you know, so what is it like? You know, it's like, you know, we're Black. And he was like, you're American. And I was like, what? I was like, no, like, you know, we're having a, I'm like, I want to talk to you because I want to understand your experience. And, blah, blah. And he was like, it won't be the same for you because you're from the United States.
Okay.
And I was like, ouch, you know, that kind of, it was kind of a gut punch because that's not how I see myself as a part of the diaspora. Like, yes, my nationality, I'm from the United States. You know, when it comes down to next summer for the Olympics, I'm rooting for Team USA. Yes, because I'm from the United States. I am. You know, we're going up against the Jamaicans, you know, in track and field. You know, it's the way it is.
Yeah.
But I also see myself as a person, a part of global Blackness, as a person of the diaspora, a descendant of African people. And even to a certain extent, I see myself as African. So to kind of be told by, you know, an African from the continent, well, no, not you. I was like,
do you feel sad when you hear this?
It was, I don't know if sad, I felt a little rejected.
Okay.
And he wasn't being mean. It wasn't, he was just trying to get me to understand the social experience, like the social order of where I was. It wasn't, he wasn't being mean. So these are just my own feelings.
Yes.
But you know, it was like a power I didn't want. Like I didn't want to be special. I wanted to just like be in community and just like, oh, okay, so do you do this? Because we do this. Do you do that? Like to just like have these this
building
exchange
connection,
to connect and figure out like what things that we do similar still. Like, you know, it's like, oh, well, we eat this. Do you still eat that? Or it's just like, you know, have these different connections. And to kind of to have this like, well, yes, these things are true, but in this context, in this, you know, European context, particularly in this Western European context, you are from the United States. And that's what people will read first. And so therefore we will not have the same experience. And it was also kind of like this heaviness or responsibility, because it's like, so what am I supposed to do about that? Like, because I don't like.
No, it's not, how to say, it's not your mistake or fault.
Right. And it's like, but in my own country, I don't have a level of power that other people have to change anything inside it. But you're saying here in this context, I now have this social capital, this potential power that I don't even know how to exercise and I don't even recognize because all of my life I have not had it. And so it is like, it is really just like this mind trip of, and then like also like, you know, so, you know, if I want to be on vacation, like, I believe like there was something happening.
Okay.
And like, no, it was like coming up on like Emancipation Day for Amsterdam. I wasn't going to be there, but there were other activities. And they're like, you know, and I was like, so am I supposed to participate in like the, you know, Emancipation Day because I'm Black? Or am I allowed to be on vacation? Or like, am I expected to, you know, participate in global Blackness and be like, yeah, we're here protesting? Or like, it was just like, what am I supposed to be doing?
Yeah, you know.
I felt like, I just felt really, really confused and a little bit disoriented around like, and somewhat guilty, right? Because I'm like, oh, I just came here to have a good time. I didn't really, you know, I didn't want to, I just came to have a few cocktails. I didn't want to like get into like this deep conversation around, you know, and so like, it's still something I think about. I still think about it. I still think about like the conversations I had in Nairobi, the experiences I had in Europe, and like, you know, understanding the concept around like global Blackness outside of this abstract. Cause like, you know, the abstract is, we are Black and blah, blah, blah. But then like,
when you zoom in,
I was like, oh, you know, and but we, you know, we think about it and we, and particularly in the United States, like we do yearn to be connected, you know, knowing that, you know, you know, Black college students were some of the most vocal people against apartheid in South Africa. Like we have always seen ourselves in connection. Like we have a whole neighborhood here in Birmingham where the streets are named after freedom fighters from South African apartheid. You know, it's like there's always been like this connection and this concern about what is happening to Black people, whether it be in Haiti, whether it be what's going on in the Dominican Republic, two Haitians or two people who appear to be too dark. Just all these different contexts, we've always been concerned and felt like this connection and kinship. And so I think I was probably too high. I was like, really happy. I was like, yes, you know, here we are.
Yeah,
and they
were like,
hold on.
Like, exactly. We are not exactly the same. And other challenges you face when you work as an urbanist?
I think also like in the domestic sense, there's like this concept of urbanism, right? Like this this concept that the city is not haphazard, right? Because I think that, because I asked people, I was like, you ever like walk around and like wonder why why is the house right here or as opposed to over there, or why is this building here? And often people are like, no. Like, so there's this and I'm not sure how we quite got there. I guess you know, if you're born, if you didn't create something, you assume it just exists.
It just existed.
You're not investigating how it came to exist or why does it exist or who put it there. It was there when you got here. And so you just kind of move on. But one of the things that I struggle, not a struggle, but a challenge that I, you know, that I put towards people, I'm like, be inquisitive about your environment. Like, don't just take for granted just because something is there that it's going to always be there, that it has to be there, that it should be there. You know, just like really working to get people to like be curious. And in a lot of communities, like curiosity can be deadly, right? Like you don't get to ask questions. You don't get to, you know, you were discouraged from those things. Mm. You weren't allowed access to plans and information. And so as a means of survival, you just had to take whatever was given.
Exactly.
To you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I'm saying, no, you don't have to do that. Mm. Like, I want you to ask why the sidewalk is on this side of the street and not on this side of the street. I want you to call and ask, you know, people. I want you to have access to architects so they can explain to you why buildings look the way they do, or why does it have to go this way? Like, I want you to be able to access folks who work in infrastructure so they can explain to you what's going on. Like, why is the road
exactly
torn? Like, what are you putting in the ground? Why don't you have high speed internet? you know, I want people to be more inquisitive and be and have a better understanding. Because I don't like, I think people often think that we want people to do stuff. I want you to understand, because then in your own mind, in your own genius, once you understand something, then like you can, then your brain will work. You will start to extrapolate. You will start to think about things as a resident. And then like, you don't really need me anymore. Like once you understand, okay, I understand how this works. I understand why sidewalks are important. Then you're going to go advocate for sidewalks. You're like, well, now that I understand why it's important for me to have a sidewalk in my neighborhood, I want a sidewalk. I want it right now.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, it's that empowerment. It's like, I want people to come to City Hall. I tell folks outside, please come to public meetings.
Yeah.
Please come to the council meeting. Because I want you to understand, because I want you there to ask questions and I want you to feel involved, because to me, that's, it's only good. I mean, yes, there are going to be people who are just ridiculous, but I think it's always a net positive to have people informed and interested.
Yes.
And not only showing up when something negatively impacts them.
Yeah.
It's like, I want you here all the time. You know, I want you here, you know, talking about, you know, housing, or like, how can we be proactive if we have people who are aging, you know, how are we working with them, you know, and their families to make sure that they keep the house in their family and they have the resources that they need to move through the legal process and create an estate plan so they'll know what's happening. And this is not something that we're working on while also trying to bury somebody. You know, I want children more involved. I know you specialize with kids, but I mean, like, I think kids just feel, you know, in an adult world, like, you know, things just happen. You have no control, no say. And, you know, I think that breeds a certain kind of distance and helplessness. You know, I think it also, like, I think we inadvertently teach children not to advocate for themselves and not to have agency because we don't include them in public processes.
No.
And so then we wonder why, you know, children may experience something and then they don't report it. And it's like, well, you know, you did kick them out the meeting. You know, that is a challenge of is getting people to kind of turn a corner. And I'm saying, I want you here. I'm not saying don't come to City Hall.
Yeah.
I want you here. I want you to ask questions. I want you to be curious. And I want you to do tactical urbanism. Like, you cannot make permanent changes to city infrastructure.
Yeah.
But if you want to host a block party, if you want to, you know, put wildflowers in the medians, or on the public right of way, you know, because the grass doesn't get as cut as often as it should, because our, you know, public works department is spread so thin. So like, we've had people who are just like, oh, we'll just take care of it. We'll just plant something else that doesn't need to be mowed and maintained, but it's still beautiful. And there's, you know, we'll just do it. And so I, you know, probably much to the chagrin of other people I work with, I am always encouraging
That's people good. Yeah.
to take it, you know, to be curious and to act in their own best interest yeah. in their own cities.
That's good. And Carmen, like, you are so passionate about what you work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you, how do you keep the work-life balance? How do you interpret the work-life balance rule in your life?
Well, you know, someone's asked me this before, and I was like, you know, I love cities.
Yeah.
So it doesn't like work. So even if I'm like on vacation, like I actually did go on vacation this year where I wasn't working.
Yeah.
But I was still observing everything in the city. I was like, oh my gosh, why are there so many lights? Like, it doesn't stop. You know, I'm looking, oh, that's an interesting park. Or, you know, like, oh, they have a light rail system. So even if I'm not, even if I'm getting ready to go to the Beyonce concert, which is what I was doing, like I'm walking in downtown Charlotte and I'm like observing the pedestrian spaces and all these things, like it doesn't actually stop. My brain is always in urbanism mode,
active,
which is not a bad thing. You know, again, I had a wonderful time at the Beyonce concert. I walked to the Beyonce concert and got to observe all these different things. But I do take vacations. I am also very family oriented. I spend a lot of time with my parents and nieces and nephews, siblings. We're also RVers, so we go out in nature and, you know, hang out and go to the beach. So there's a lot, there's downtime. And also, like, I am, I'm a big fan of like mystery shows, particularly like international mysteries, or like BBC and CBC shows. They're like, I just started Murdoch Mysteries. I just found out about it. I'm a big Doctor Who fan. I'm a big fan of Call the Midwife. I love the BBC. I love like foreign shows. Are very interesting to me. And so I do watch a lot of TV, probably more than I should. But also there's exercise. I work it out.
Yeah. So there is no like a clear separation. From 8 to 5, I'm an urbanista, and from 5 to 12, I'm Carmen.
No, Carmen is an urbanist.
I'm
always an urbanist. Now, I'm not always on duty as chief of staff to my counselor.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not always on duty as running my company, the CEO of my company. But I'm always an urbanist. I'm always, and this is, I've always just been curious about how we organize ourselves in society and the accompanying infrastructure. So it doesn't matter where I am or what's going on. I'm always going to be looking and noticing, this neighborhood doesn't have any gutters. or no, this is interesting. You know, I'm always going to do that.
Yeah.
And, I'm okay with that. I don't feel like it's overkill. It doesn't feel overwhelming.
Yeah.
I'm never saying, oh, I wish I could stop.
I understand.
It's just, you know, it's just the way it is. It's like, you know, it's just like how I see.
I mean, so far you're happy and you're not causing a harm to somebody else. So why not? Like, you can be urbanist 24/7 and that's it.
Well, yeah. But I think like other people who are passionate, like you know, asking like, I have friends who are doctors.
Yeah.
And it's like, it doesn't matter that they're not at work. If, you know, they're still noticing, if they hear someone coughing or choking, like they're still going to be able to notice. And so I think it's kind of like that when you have a calling, when you're passionate about something, it's just a part of who you are. So you're always going to be attuned to it, but you're not always at work. Like, I don't have to do it. Like, I can see that there should be a stop sign right there. But I'm not going to call anybody and be like, y'all need to get a stop. Like, I'm just going to notice.
Yeah, you just move on.
Yeah, just move it on. but yeah, I'm not going to do anything about it.
And it's super inspiring and fun to talk to you. Like, you're funny in a way. It's good conversation. And now we are like, how to say, we explored your work with the council, with elevators, and also like the how you observe the world as a Black American. Of course, we didn't touch on many different topics as well, but I hope this is like the first conversation we are having in the podcast, and more to be continued. We are in the last section of this episode, and it's more about messages. So the first question is that, what is your message to Carmen, to yourself?
Okay, wait a minute. Eve, you said this beforehand. I don't know why I'm stumbling through this. But I think just to keep going. You know, every time I think, every time that I've tried something new or I've tried to fly, so to speak, it's always worked out. So, you know, or even when it felt like it wasn't working out in the most immediate terms, like I can look back over my experiences and say, oh, that actually did work out. Like, you know, so I would, you know, always encourage myself to continue to try, continue to take risks, continue to be a little, continue to be loud and continue to be visible and take up space and, you know, just continue. And just, because it can be, you know, it can be shaky sometimes. You can, you know, I can experience doubt around, is this really working? Like, are people really hearing me? Are they really understanding what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, are people really actually interested, you know, in what I'm talking about? Like, do they understand how important and impactful this is? And, you know, anytime I've experienced that, I've had a gentle reminder of, no, yes, this is good. You should keep going. So, my message to myself is definitely keep going.
Keep going, Carmen. Yeah. And three takeaway messages to our listeners.
Oh, okay. So I would say, if you're working with community, you know, because my three things: be honest, have integrity, you know, couple that humility with your expertise. Excuse me. And, you know, really have a good time. Like, if you're really passionate about this, I don't experience burnout because I'm passionate. Yeah. And also, you know, manage myself pretty well to make sure that I'm not, you know, overworking myself.
Yeah.
But just keep that passion for whatever it is that you love, because it's there on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, it is not just this. It's not an accident that you feel the way you do. Like, you have a purpose if you have a passion. And so keep nurturing that passion, so you can do what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. And last question in this episode is going to be asked by you. So I don't have questions. Now it's your turn to ask our listeners a question.
Ooh, okay. So I guess a good question would be.
Yeah.
When you dream of cities, what does that look like? Like, what is, you know, what does it taste like? What does it sound like? You know, your ideal city, when you dream of cities, how do your senses engage it? What does it feel like? You know, what does it look like? What does it taste like? Who's there? I would love to understand how we see our highest selves as it relates to cities.
Good question. Great. Well, Carmen, thank you so much again for giving your time, and I was really happy to see you in the Pontevedra. Now we are having this conversation. I'm really looking forward to see you ERL and to continue our conversation, maybe digitally or ERL, when we meet again.
Yes. I'm sure I'll be back on that side of the world.
Yes.
Sometime next year.
Yeah, hopefully. So keep up the good work.
Thank you. You do the same.